Hello and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. We appreciate all of you. A special thank you to Undivided subscribers who help us do this show. A lot to talk about today, including an unbelievable, Jason Rance had this story and it was just great, about this art project, publicly funded art project in the city of Tacoma that is just blatantly racist, but apparently it's okay because it's racism against whites and apparently that's acceptable in the United States, which is very odd. Also, remember we talked about Bob Ferguson launching an exploratory campaign? Well, his exploratory campaign also includes like 150 endorsements that he already had ready to go, which is odd considering it's just exploratory. Later on, Peter Doocy and Karine Jean-Pierre had an absolutely outrageous exchange in the White House briefing room when Peter Doocy was asking a simple question about the crisis at the southern border. Karine Jean-Pierre got very offensive. Also, we're going to talk about a debate on The View about whether Antifa is a real thing, which always has me triggered because people try to downplay Antifa who've never actually been assaulted or vilified by Antifa. Before we get to all that, Nicole, hello.
Oh, hi, Randy.
Well,
hi, Randy.
We had a little bit of a race up to the show today.
We sure did.
Getting new elements in. We're all, what is, kerfuffle? It was a kerfuffle.
A little bit of a kerfuffle.
We're good. I'm glad that you found the View clip on Antifa, because it genuinely angers me when people pretend like Antifa isn't a thing.
Just because they don't do interviews. I feel like that's the reason, because they don't see them doing interviews in the media, then it doesn't exist to them.
There's a lot that triggers me about it, but would you need them to have, like, to register as a political action committee and to have a building that they lease out and it says Antifa on the building? What do you need, Whoopi Goldberg, to consider Antifa real? So we'll get to that later, and I'm very curious to hear your
vision of them. It's not what I envision because I've never come into contact with them, but it's not what I have seen in videos of them going after anybody.
Whoopi Goldberg has an interesting vision of most things.
The View is an interesting vision itself.
It is. Okay, we'll get to that. All right, Nicole, thank you. But first, the title of today's episode is a very special, special session. And I mean special in the way that your mom might tell you that you're special, So Governor Jay Inslee has now set a special session for May 16th. And look, I think a special session needs to happen. If you haven't been following it, it's this issue around, are we going to criminalize drug possession in Washington state? The obvious common sense answer is, well, yes, of course we should. But lawmakers had 4 months during the actual legislative session when they were all in Olympia to try to get that done before our existing law around drug possession sunsets on July 1st. And they couldn't do it. And now we're to believe that behind the scenes, if given another month on top of the 4 months they already had, they can get something done. Now, Governor Inslee came out the last night of the legislative session when they didn't get a bill across the finish line and basically said, that's unacceptable. We're going to, you know, make them come to a consensus and I'll schedule a special session when we have a deal so everyone can come back, do a quick vote on it and move on with their lives. Now, what's really interesting is the governor came out yesterday officially, and we talked on the show that he was expected to do this. And after the live show yesterday, he did. And he put out a statement saying basically there's no deal yet. He said details are still being negotiated, but caucus leaders share the desire to pass a bill. I believe that starting the clock on May 16th will put us on a path to getting the job done this month. So this is part of his statement coming out and saying he's scheduling a special session for May 16th, despite the fact that there is no deal yet. Which I said yesterday is utter stupidity and very irresponsible, because if, and maybe the governor is doing this by design, but I think if you push too quickly without there being time to craft something that has enough votes, my fear is that Democrats will default to the weaker version of the bill just so the governor doesn't look stupid if they show up on May 16th and there's no deal yet. And that's terrifying to me, because the weaker version of the bill that progressives in the House want would have no impact on the drug crisis that's happening in our communities right now. No impact whatsoever. So anyway, Senator John Braun, who is the top-ranking Republican in Olympia, he's the Republican leader on the Senate side, he put out a lengthy statement. I'll read part of it for you. He said, "While I am hopeful for a better outcome this next time around, There is also reason to be cautious. The House Democrats will need to demonstrate a combination of bipartisanship and leadership that was missing during the 105 days of the regular session. And, you know, he said in the statement that he was surprised by the governor's decision to schedule a special session before they had a deal. And what that says to me is that Republicans aren't being consulted. And so when I, you know, read the governor's comments saying caucus leaders share the desire to pass a bill, I wonder how much actual conversations the governor's office and Democrats have had with Republicans. And need I remind you that, first of all, we shouldn't even be here. They could have fixed this 2 years ago very easily by adding one word to state law on drug possession to make it constitutional again. We didn't even have to be here, but progressive Democrats saw it as an opportunity to decriminalize drugs, which a wing of their party has been trying to do and is continuing to try to do today, which is why we're in this situation with no bill. But, you know, Democrats and Republicans in the Washington State Senate, they came up with a great compromise bill. It got 14 Democratic votes, 14 Republican votes, passed out of the Senate. And you would think, like, that's exactly what we want government to do, is a great bipartisan bill would have made a difference in our drug crisis, would have saved lives, would have reduced crime. And then it got over to the House, and there's like a handful of uber leftist Democrats who are like, no, that goes too far in criminalizing drug use. And so Democrats let just a handful of people derail the whole thing, derail all that hard work to get to a bipartisan agreement on what drug possession laws in this state should look like. And so I think the real question on May 16th is, who are Democrats going to side with? Who is the Democratic Party in Washington State going to side with? Are you going to side with a handful of extreme leftists who want de facto drug legalization? Or are you going to side with the other half of your party and all of the Republican Party in trying to come up with something that is actually going to make a difference? And I frankly don't know the answer to that. I don't know what Democrats will do at the end of the day, but whatever they do is going to have a profound impact on public safety in our state. And so I know we call to action a lot. Just because the legislative session is over doesn't mean I want you to stop emailing your elected leaders. I think that everyone watching and listening should send an email to both Senator Andy Billig and Speaker of the House Lori Jenkins, and you can find their email addresses easily online. And you should tell them that you want them to support the bipartisan bill that passed in the Senate and that you do not want to see it watered down. And keep your emails kind, but explain why. Explain the impact that the drug crisis is having on you, is having on your communities, and urge them to do the right thing. I think that's very, very important to make sure they know that just because the legislative session is over, we're all still paying attention. And we're not going to let them pass through some weak bill on May 16th, go to Olympia, pass it, and then go back to their legislative districts and act like nothing ever happened. It's absolutely absurd. The governor should not have scheduled something before they had a deal. I don't understand what's going on with that man. All right, moving on. So you guys know that social housing passed in the city of Seattle. And, oh, man, Ari Hoffman, our friend Ari Hoffman over at KVI, he sent me this video last night, and because he just knew we were going to want to play it on the show. But so there has been 13 people appointed to a board that's tasked with sort of the implementation of the social housing program in Seattle. Now, I will say that, look, it's 13 people, and not all of them are crazy. But Ari Hoffman sent me this clip of, first of all, it's Councilwoman Tammy Morales, who we talked about on the show the other day, who is socialist adjacent. She's the one who said hard pass to criminalizing hard drugs. And so she's asking members of this new board, this 13-person social housing development board, to introduce themselves. And look, I am not going to judge a book by its cover. I'm not going to judge the appearance of some of these individuals, but I want you to actually listen to their words, in particular, the final words of the last person that we're going to play for you here. Listen.
In a way, we're sort of in uncharted waters here, but in another sense, we're walking down a very well-taken path, and this board will be the ones leading us. This board represents a broad array of experience and knowledge, from lived experience of housing instability, homelessness, and accessing services in our current ecosystem, as well as public finance, labor representation, public policy, nonprofit affordable housing development, social housing, and regional planning experience. So with that, I want to welcome our panelists here. Okay, I'm going to turn to the folks who are online, and I will just call on you.
Oh, God, here we go.
You could introduce yourself, Ibo.
Hello, my name is Ibo Barton. I use he, him pronouns. And I have lived experience with being chronically homeless, as well as professional experience working in permanent supportive housing, along with supporting the gender diverse community of Seattle.
Thank you. Katie?
Hi, my name is Katie LeBret. I am a trans woman who lives in Seattle. I have experience with working with youth, young adults, like, you know, the younger generation of us. I also have lived experience with being homeless as well and navigating the systems.
Thank you. Devin.
Hi, my name is Devin Horschmidt. I'm one of the board members appointed by the Seattle Renters Coalition. I am a lifelong renter or renter for my whole adult life. Professionally, I am a Head Start teacher, so I work with low-income and largely immigrant families. I have also had a lot of experience living in homes with unsafe conditions and poor maintenance and have that piece of lived experience. I am also a member of the Party for Socialism and Liberation and the Answer Coalition.
Look. I want those headphones. They're fancy. With
oh
the lights.
My gosh, I'm crying.
You really tried I'm to hold crying. That in. It just made it worse.
I was trying so hard to hold that in. Look, again, I'm not trying to judge by appearance, but that second person couldn't even explain what their experience was to be on this board.
Right.
I have experience working with the youths.
I like that lived experience.
Lived experience. Well, we all know the only kind of lived experience that actually matters is experience that aligns with their ideology.
Exactly.
If you have any other lived experience, it doesn't matter at all. But then you... Yeah, the person at the end who's like, oh yeah, and I'm a socialist. It's like... I thought you were talking about your qualifications for the job.
That person is teaching children. That makes me feel real good.
I'm literally, I have snot coming out of my nose. I was trying so hard. Michelle says, Brandy giving us Dory LOL vibes. Oh, man. Wow. Okay. Yeah. And again, like, look, you know, if they want to have green hair,
in a way,
I'm not
we're
really.
Sort of in
no, please play it again.
Waters.
Actually, yeah. Yes. Let's play it again.
But here, I'm going to skip ahead to
okay, go
to that person. Maybe.
Hi, my name is Devin Horschmidt. I'm one of the board members appointed by the Seattle Renters, Coalition. I am a lifelong renter or renter for my whole adult life. Professionally, I am a Head Start teacher, so I work with low-income and largely immigrant families. I have also had a lot of experience living in homes with unsafe conditions and poor maintenance and have that piece of lived experience. I am also a member of the Party for Socialism and Liberation and the Answer Coalition.
Everything up to that is fine. It's until they get on this, and again, they're at a city meeting talking about why, you know, I'm on I'm a socialist. And I guess for social housing, maybe it makes sense to have socialists run social housing. But it's actually the second person in that clip that really gets to me where they cannot express what their actual qualification is to be on this 13-person committee. They can't come up with it. Their qualification is, I've worked with youths.
youth/younger generation.
Oh my gosh. Daryl says, by the way, Daryl's in the chat. He says, okay, Nicole, I'm ordering the headphones for you. So next time you see Nicole on the show, she'll have the green.
Wait, don't do it.
Okay. Daryl, she says, don't do it. Anyway. Look, Seattle's doomed. I said, Seattle's like a parody. Now, I do want to be fair and say that it's a 13-person board. There are individuals who have, for instance, there is one woman named Julie Howe, experience in housing development and asset management.
Can you imagine having to work with the rest of them? Like, you come in with serious background, with experience, and you have to deal with.
And then you have the one person who says, I've worked with youths. I was like, oh my gosh. Anyway, okay. Mm-hmm. Try not to be mean, but that cracked me up. Thank you, Ari Hoffman, for pulling those clips so we didn't have to go back and listen to that whole panel, because I don't think that I would have made it through it. Oh, Seattle is doomed. And it goes back to, by the way, the identity obsession. Like, the obsession with identity over any other qualification a person has. Do you think those individuals will be on the panel if they weren't, like, transgender? No. The second person who said they were transgender and actually could not get a sentence out defining or explaining what their qualifications are, do you think they would be on that panel if they weren't transgender? No. It is about identity at any cost. And that's just a stupid way to run government. It's a stupid way to run anything. Okay. Let's see here. Oh, I had to do a little catch up on Bob Ferguson's exploratory campaign. We wanted to see how it's going because Bob Ferguson announced his exploratory campaign for governor, which of course, you know, doesn't exist because there is no such thing under Washington's campaign finance laws. You're either a candidate or you're not. But I found it very funny that he puts out this long video explaining that it's simply exploratory, right? And he's going to go across the state and do listening tours to everyone to see if, you know, what they want him to run. But then just a few hours after announcing, or was it the next day?
No, hours.
Oh, it was hours. You're right, because he announced yesterday. And then yes. Later in the day, he sends out a tweet. Take a look at this. Sends out a tweet. First of all, there's lots to unpack about this tweet. But he says, we're kicking off this race with over 150 endorsements from current and former elected officials. I've been blown away by the support we've received across Washington, up and down the ballot. It's clear to me this isn't just a campaign. It's a movement. Okay. I thought it wasn't a campaign at all.
I'm pretty sure you were exploring before you announced your exploratory.
Yeah, I thought it was an exploration. I didn't realize it was a campaign. And then he lists, you know, 150 or so, more than 150 endorsements that he already has in the can. So clearly it's a campaign. So it's just silly to me. I will say I'm gonna call out one of them that
I'm okay with it.
Immediately stuck out to me yesterday. One of the endorsements is from Federal Way Mayor Jim Farrell. How shooketh was I when I saw that yesterday?
You were very shooketh.
Yes, I was. That the kids say shooketh. I'm trying to maintain my youth because I love Jim Farrell. I mean, love in a... If Jim Farrell's wife, if you're watching, it's not like that. I think he's great. I think I've had Jim on the show many times.
Yes.
He ran for King County Prosecutor. I thought that was the most important race in November.
And we all tried so hard to get him in there.
Oh my gosh. It was like, it was so common sense.
Yes.
And, you know, Jim was a Democrat or was the Republican up until I think 2012. Mm-hmm. And then he switched over to the Democratic Party. And so, you know, when he ran for King County Prosecutor, I think that's a nonpartisan race, but he ran still being a Democrat. But he's so common sense on crime and public safety, very middle of the road. And so I was just shocked to see his name on there, and I found out that he's known Bob Ferguson for a long time, so I don't know to the extent that, you know, a lifelong personal friendship might influence that endorsement.
I can see that, I guess. I mean, in this case, you're picking somebody who's making decisions. Do you agree with their decisions, not just on being friends with them, right?
Well, I know, but I wrestle with that, because if you ran for something and I didn't agree with you, would I endorse your campaign? Would I use my, you know... Jim Farrell is very influential. And I would tend to say yes.
I don't know. If I don't necessarily
but you
think
and
that's
I are
true.
Very you and I are pretty aligned politically.
Yes.
And so if you were totally different from me politically, I don't think I would endorse you.
Right. I agree. And I don't think you would, because I think that your vision of what you want for the state would not align, and that's what you're voting for there. Is somebody that makes decisions closest to what you would make. And then I also think it's interesting that, you know, all of these people are lined up, and it makes me so sad because they all are doing that because they think it's already decided. They're like, yep, we knew for the last 2 years he was going to be the next guy. We'll just throw our support behind him. And that's probably why Dow bowed out, right? Because all of those people said, no, we'll take Fergie over Dow. And Dow's like, okay, then I got to get out. I have to like come out ahead of time and say, no, I'm not running. Don't worry about me. But he already knew all of those people were supporting Ferguson.
Yeah, I'm sure behind the scenes he's like, we get on my campaign, we get on my campaign. Everybody's like, no, I already promised Bob.
Yep.
And there is a little bit of annoyance that I think Bob feels like, and a lot of people feel like, he's just the heir apparent.
Yep.
That the next 18 months are just sort of a matter of course.
Exactly.
And you just need to do the campaign to do the campaign. And it bothers me a lot. Oh, and look.
The butt kissing.
The butt. But is it probably true? I mean, at this point, mm-hmm. yeah. But I'm not ruling out the fact that you might have someone who enters the race and creates a lot of excitement, is able to bridge parties, et cetera. Oh. And maybe, but that's why would you endorse someone on the first day? You don't even know who's going to get in, but that just shows that they really feel like. What if another friend
joins the...
I know, right? Anyway.
There was some people on his list. That,
Jim Farrell, you're still welcome on the show. I still think you're a great politician. I still appreciate what you've done in Olympia this session to advocate for public safety.
And I hope you're in his ear then.
Get in his ear, try to get him to actually prioritize public safety. I mean, Bob Ferguson's the chief law enforcement officer of Washington State. Mm-hmm. Yet what has he done to help public safety? You know, he announced a retail theft task force like a year after downtown Seattle was looted to the studs.
Right.
Like I was down there, mannequins, naked mannequins in the streets. He didn't say anything about that. And it's like he only stepped up on public safety issues when it's politically convenient for him, which is a scary thing. And it's the antithesis of what Jim Farrell has stood for, which is law and order. Mm-hmm. And so maybe you're right. Maybe it'd be just good for Jim Farrell to get in his ear and have someone with common sense in your corner who can be like, hey, we're really unsafe and you need to prioritize right. these things.
I hope that's
But how I just help. Had to say that really, I was very shocked by that, as I mm-hmm. said, that I was shooketh. By that endorsement. But Jim Farrell's a smart man. I'm sure he has his reasons.
Did we mention that he did not support Farrell and his
Well, I'm still trying to figure out if he asked for his endorsement. Because we went to Jim Farrell's campaign site when he ran for King County Prosecutor. And I said, hey, see if Bob Ferguson's name on there. And we don't see it.
Nope.
Now, that doesn't... Maybe Jim didn't ask for it. Maybe Jim didn't think that would be helpful to his campaign. I don't know. So I'm working on getting an answer on that. So we will see.
Interesting.
Anyway, thought you guys should know. Okay, coming up in a moment, there is an art project in the city of Tacoma that is just flat out racist, but apparently it's okay because it's racist against white people. But first, First Mark Insurance, I told you guys this week that I took the First Mark Challenge. My friend Dory Monson talked about it on his radio show for years about taking the First Mark Challenge, and Mike and I decided to do it. We decided we're getting married. I had terrible car insurance. You know, we're going to have the house together. And so we took the First Mark Challenge. And it was such an awesome process of feeling, one, like I said yesterday, like an adult. Like, oh, wow, I'm really doing something that an adult would do. But one of the things Mike and I realized, because the way the First Mark Challenge works, and if you go to firstmarkinsurance.com, you can click on Take the First Mark Challenge. They do a full review of all the insurance that you have right now and the insurance that you should have that you don't, or insurance you have that you don't need. And then they'll go out, and First Mark Insurance works for you. They're basically a concierge for you. They are not, they're on your side, not the side of the insurance company, which is really nice. And they go out and try to find the best possible insurance for you. They bring it back to you. They present you literally with a side-by-side of, here's what you have now. Here's what we think you should get. And you can kind of compare and contrast the pros and the cons. Here is Dave Taylor, the CEO of First Mark, explaining kind of the end of the process.
Sometimes those findings may lead to a recommendation to stay with your current provider for the time being and just make a few changes to your coverage. Most often though, we will be able to find you a better option, and our recommendation will be to move from your current carrier over to First Mark.
Yeah, and that's what Mike and I did starting on May 1st. Mike and I are now part of the First Mark family, and I'd love for you to be part of the First Mark family as well. And Dave Taylor is just amazing. So go to firstmarkinsurance.com. Again, that's firstmarkinsurance.com. And you can find a little tab there to take the First Mark Challenge. And if you take it and you realize, hey, it's not going to save me money, or I'm not going to get better insurance, then that's what they're going to tell you is, hey, you should probably just stick with your current plan. For Mike and I, we found out we were woefully underinsured, which was scary because we've worked really hard for what we have. So to know we weren't protected was mortifying. And so we were able to dramatically increase our insurance coverage for about the same price as what we were paying before for far inferior coverage. So take the First Mark Challenge and let me know how it goes. All right, let's get to our segment, Unbelievable. All All right, our friend Jason Rantz, he always finds these little gems. He has this great story. It's up at mynorthwest.com. And by great story, I mean soul-sucking. The headline, City of Tacoma Art Project will purposefully include a racist quote. And I read that. I was like, "How? What kind of racist quote would they allow to be on an art project?" So according to Jason Rantz in this article, the City of Tacoma knowingly funding an art project featuring what's described as a racist and divisive quote. So this is a $12 million project that is funded through a combination of state and local taxes, according to Jason. So it's being put together by a group called Spaceworks, which Jason describes as a left-wing art initiative between the City of Tacoma and the Tacoma Pierce County Chamber. And so it is that the task for them is to create a streetscape around the Hilltop neighborhood in Tacoma, and it's near the Tacoma Link extension. And there's the article if you're watching on the live stream. City of Tacoma Art Project will purposefully include racist quote. So, oh my gosh. So I was like, oh gosh, I'm very curious what this racist quote is going to be. So they include a message from Martin Luther King Jr., Nelson Mandela, and Ozzie Davis, who I've never heard of. Can you Google who Ozzie Davis is? Thanks, Nicole. And one of the quotes that they selected for this art project, it was actually, and I don't know if it was the contractor that flagged Jason to this, but there was a Tacoma-based contractor who was reviewing the project and what it was going to entail and what the quotes were going to be and accepting requests for the proposals. And the quote itself is from a writer named Michael Denzel. And it reads as follows. The only limitations placed on blackness are those imposed by the white imagination. Again, this is a publicly funded art project that is supposed to go on Tacoma's hilltop next to public transit. And it's supposed to have a quote on it that says, the only limitations placed on blackness are those imposed by the white imagination. So Jason said he reached out to the City of Tacoma to ask, hey, is that appropriate? Which is a very reasonable question. And Jason says a spokesperson did not comment directly, but explained that the community would lead the whole process to decide what the artwork was going to say. And Jason said that his takeaway was that the city was basically endorsing the quote. And I don't know if they think it's covered by the First Amendment or what it is. Did you look up who that person is, Nicole?
Yes, he's a writer and an actor. He was activist as well.
An activist. So. Gotcha. This is incredibly inappropriate because it's basically saying, hey, if you are a black person, you feel held down, it's because of white people. And it's 2023. This is a publicly funded art project. And for the City of Tacoma to defer and say, oh, well, the community led the selection process for what the art project would be. Okay, if you had a white community and you had people in that community who wanted to put some quote up or like a picture of someone with a KKK hood, would you be like, oh, well, or like a swastika? Oh, that was the community. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we got to let the community decided. And so you just let like the swastika up? Of course you wouldn't. And this is absolutely no different. It is 100% racist. There is no way that public funds should be going to a project like that. And for the City of Tacoma to be so deeply obsessed with identity that they would actually totally push off this question from Jason Rantz and wouldn't look at that and say, you know what, there's a lot of other quotes that we can put that are empowering to people of all skin colors and backgrounds on a project that's going to be adjacent to public transit. We don't need this quote that is incredibly divisive, blatantly racist. You're telling me you can't find a single other quote to put in place of it. The City of Tacoma should be absolutely ashamed of itself. And the City of Tacoma is rapidly approaching Seattle levels of insanity. Completely unbelievable. Great get by Jason Rantz on that. I really hope that they change their minds on that project before it's too late. Okay, are you in the market to sell your home? Then you got to visit sellwithwes.com and talk to our friend Wes Jones about the state of the real estate market and, you know, whether it's the best time for you to sell your home or whether you should wait a little bit longer. And he was telling us that he does see kind of a window of opportunity to be able to get multiple offers again, to be able to get a cash offer for your home. Here is Wes Jones of sellwithwes.com.
What I know right now is that today it's a pretty solid time. If you are listed on the market, you are likely to be one of the only homes for sale in your neighborhood. And that is a fantastic position to be in. Where are we at in 3 or 4 months? Well, if interest rates go up, buyers have less purchasing power and homes will probably take longer, which means that you will likely be competing against more of your neighbors.
And that's why you also need someone like Wes Jones in his innovative marketing strategy. They have a plan to get the most possible eyeballs on your home locally, even internationally. So if you want to sell your home at a higher price with fewer contingencies, visit sellwithwes.com. That's sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. All right, let's dip outside of Washington State momentarily. Wow, this is a doozy. A doozy. It's a doozy from Peter Doocy. So there has been, for a while, a confrontational relationship between Fox News White House correspondent Peter Doocy and White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre. And oftentimes, it's sassiness that's not even warranted. You know, Peter Doocy will ask a completely legitimate question that has news value, and Karine Jean-Pierre will automatically be on the defensive. And I'm not saying that Fox doesn't have an agenda. Of course they do, but it's no more of an agenda than MSNBC or NBC or other network correspondents. So you might have been following the news that there has been a tremendous surge of migrants at the southern border, thousands and thousands and thousands coming up to the southern border at once. And so naturally, you would hope that Karine Jean-Pierre, when she had her daily White House press briefing, would be expecting questions about that surge, about what's happening at the southern border. And so that is exactly what Peter Doocy asks about. And I want you to listen to the response he got from Karine Jean-Pierre.
When it comes to illegal migration, you've seen it come down by more than 90%. Where did that number come from?
It was, I was speaking.
CBP is telling us the number is.
I hear you. I'm about to answer.
136,000 people more.
I'm about to answer you.
Year so
if
far.
If the dramatics could come down just a little bit. If the dramatics could come down a little
what's
bit.
What's dramatic about asking a question about?
Okay, I'm going to answer. So I was speaking to the parolee program. As you know, the president put in place a parolee program to deal with certain countries on ways that we can limit illegal migration. And we have seen, the data has shown us, that it has gone down by more than 90%.
So first of all, and I might have you play that again, Nicole, but when he is, first of all, his question is legitimate. And she immediately cuts. Could you just play the first part of that?
When it comes to illegal migration, you've seen it come down by more than 90%. Where did that number come from?
It was, I was speaking.
CBP is telling us the number is.
I hear you. I'm about to answer.
136,000 people.
Okay, you can cut it off there. He's not done asking his question yet. And she's the one interrupting him. And then she's like, oh, I'll answer. Just bring the dramatics down a little bit. And he's like, what's dramatic about asking a question? What he's trying to do is present her with what the White House is saying versus the numbers that Border Patrol is putting out there publicly. And that just, again, we talked on the show before about tactics that politicians or people in power use when confronted by difficult questions or questions that they don't have the answers to by members of the press. And one of them, remember, is immediate defensiveness. If they are on the defensive over a legitimate question, it's either because they don't know what they're talking about and they're trying to buy time, or they know that there's no answer they can give that will justify what's going on. And I think it's a little bit of both for Karine Jean-Pierre, because you see her in the moment. She's like frantically flipping through her binder, trying to find the section on what she's supposed to say about the border situation, because I've already said she's woefully underqualified for the job. And that's what happens when you prioritize identity above all else. And so she's trying to find the section that's going to tell her what the White House messaging is on the southern border. And then she's actively attacking Peter Doocy, which again is her defense mechanism to basically make it seem like you're asking a stupid question, when she's the one who's going to probably give a stupid answer because she knows that she's been caught with her foot in her mouth. And so it's just, and I don't understand also why, when there is that kind of behavior from the lectern in the White House briefing room, why the other correspondents don't speak up. There should be a united front among the press in the briefing room to make sure that Karine Jean-Pierre isn't singling out one correspondent from a network she doesn't like and treating him that way. All the other correspondents should be like, whoa, 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 that's a legitimate question. Can you just answer it? But no, they don't like Fox. And so they're just like, oh, we'll just let Peter Ducey be treated this way, which is outrageous. I mean, when who's the CNN correspondent? Jim Acosta. When the Trump administration took his press credential away, the White House, which I thought was outrageous, by the way, the White House press corps stuck together on that one. And even Fox News came out and said, no, you can't take Jim Acosta's press credential away. That's ridiculous. And so there was a united front in that regard. And so I don't understand why it's not happening there. So truly shame on the White House correspondents who were in the briefing room and didn't immediately lose it on Karine Jean-Pierre for acting that way. But, you know, when you're underqualified for your job and you're in a high-stress situation, you're going to lash out. And that's exactly what she's doing, is lashing out. Okay. Oh, this is going to be my rant for the day. Let me stretch for this. I'm going to need a good stretch for the rant I'm about to go on. No, I'll keep it under control. So The View, which I really think The View only exists because they know they say such dumb stuff, such uninformed stuff, that they're going to get clicks. I think that's it for, is it ABC that still runs The View?
Yes.
I think so. That's all it is. It's like great for ratings because people are like, what dumb stuff are they going to say today? So today it's about Antifa. Look, I have been a reporter in Seattle for like 13 years. I spent the first decade of my career essentially as a professional riot coverer. And when you go back to Occupy Seattle, the May Day riots, I mean, the amount of time I've spent in crowds with people who called themselves Antifa, it's hours upon hours upon hours, okay? So I get livid whenever anyone wants to suggest that Antifa is some sort of creation, fear-mongering creation of the right, because you have no idea what you're talking about. So here's part of this clip in the conversation between Whoopi Goldberg and I'll have to see who else it was on The View.
I agree, they're
no
not
one
organized.
No one has found Antifa. We've heard a lot about Antifa.
We're seeing people exploiting the situation after George Floyd's murder to pursue violence, extremist agendas, anarchists like Antifa and other agitators.
Again, there is no person you can point to and say, oh, that person represents Antifa. Every time they see four black people, they think it's Antifa.
No, to be honest, it's actually largely white organizations.
Well, that's what we said.
There are people online who openly identify as Antifa.
Well, they may, and I'm going to say, I think oftentimes things like Antifa are things that are thought up, ideas that are thought up and pushed and moved.
It's insane. It's insane. Wow. Where do we even begin dissecting that? Whoopi Goldberg says, yeah, people see four black people and say it's Antifa. No, I immediately think of scrawny white people wearing all black with like pink hair when I think of Antifa. Thinking of black people doesn't even begin to come to my mind. So she has no idea what she's talking about. But also, for her to say nobody's been able to find Antifa, where do you expect to find them? Like I was saying earlier on the show, what would convince you that Antifa is a real movement, is a real thing? Would they have to register as a political action committee? Would they have to have a downtown Seattle office building that says Antifa on it? These are anarchists, right? And so their point is sort of no structure, no structural leadership, where they wouldn't have a central spokesperson. They are anti-structure. The other thing that bothers me about Antifa is I will invariably get the response from Seattle Sounders fans who have used the kind of Antifa symbol, who it means it stands for anti-fascist. And they're like, why do you hate Antifa? It stands for anti-fascist. Are you a fascist? First of all, yes, it stands for anti-fascist, but Antifa has been co-opted by a small group of individuals who want to wreak chaos and violence. And we've seen that going back from the Occupy Seattle days into the May Day riots and into the summer of 2020. They identify themselves as Antifa. And so the idea that they're hiding behind this name, which they say is anti-fascism, and then they use that to say, well, if you're against Antifa, then you must love fascism, is just the way that they try to get people to not criticize them. And for Whoopi Goldberg to say, no one's ever been able to find Antifa. And there's this constant argument about, is Antifa an idea or is it actually an organization? I would say it's a mix of both. No, it's not a structural organization. And yes, it is an idea and a concept that is shared by a group of people that turns that ideology into action. And oftentimes it's violent action. I've seen it firsthand. I've been the victim of it firsthand. So when someone like Whoopi Goldberg says Antifa doesn't exist, I take that personally. And to me, there actually should be some sort of recognition, federal designation for Antifa. Even if you're not a patch-wearing member, we have something that says Antifa. If you're carrying out acts of violence and criminal acts under the umbrella of Antifa, and that's how you're identifying yourself and your movement, because they do, then I think there should be some sort of federal criminal code associated with that. So it's just absolute absurdity to me to continue this narrative. And also, why is the left so obsessed with downplaying Antifa? Why are they so obsessed with downplaying these 20 to 25-year-old white kids, a lot of them born to privilege, who live in their parents' basement and have nothing or no care or concerns in the world, nothing to be actually angered about, nothing they're actually challenged by, and want to go out cosplay ninja and go out and break things and disturb things and disrupt things and hurt people and hurt police officers and hurt members of the press? Why is Whoopi Goldberg wasting her breath trying to paint them as a figment of America's imagination? It's very strange to me. In the same way, I would never spend my time or my energy downplaying January 6th or downplaying the summer of love in 2020. It is crazy to me how hyper-partisans will spend time and energy downplaying political violence if it's carried out in pursuit of a cause that they feel like is justified. Whoopi Goldberg, she needs to be gone from The View. Isn't this like, wasn't the anti-Semitism enough? Didn't she say something? But what was it about the Holocaust?
Yeah, she downplayed the Holocaust.
That was enough. Like, look, I'm not for cancel culture, but at the same time, like, the stupidity that's being fed to Americans.
Right. I would lump this in with the media, right? So we have to, people have to choose what to watch, and they should not be choosing this.
I know. Well, maybe
nothing's going to change because it's, I mean, this is, they're on for a reason. People are watching this crap.
Maybe we should stop playing their clips.
Well, I think you have to keep calling it out and reminding people this is garbage. Don't watch it.
But. You guys tell us in the chat, if you're watching live, should we stop playing clips from The View? I guess it's hard to have a hard and fast rule, because what if there's something truly outrageous like this? I almost hate to give them attention.
I know. We had a segment that just kind of highlighted the chaos of The View. And I mean, I think it's okay to point it out. To make sure people remember, this is not news. This is just gibberish.
It is absolute gibberish. It makes no sense. I really struggle with those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Because what we try to do on the show is, I call it political commentary for the anti-fringe, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's, I guess, two missions there. We want to platform reasonable people. So that's why you find that we have a lot of moderates on the show. Moderate guests or reasonable guests who can look past ideology. Mm-hmm. We pick our guess very carefully for a reason. We won't often have a lot of bomb throwers, because the bomb throwers are who the rest of the media wants to platform, because they come away with the outrageous headlines and clips.
Right.
And we want to give a voice to reasonable people. But at the same time, this is an active and forceful rejection of the fringes, of unreasonable people on the far left and the far right, who are not willing to consider reason or ration, who are hyper-focused on a set ideology. So I do want to platform reasonable people, but as part of pushing back against the fringes and actively rejecting them, I guess we do have to sometimes platform the dumb crap that people say, like Whoopi Goldberg.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. I think you have to call it out. This is getting headlines. This is getting... Right. Attention. And so you have to be like, it's not getting attention for the right reasons, and remind people what actually is correct and what's truth.
And I think also let people know, like, it's okay to think that's stupid and to say and to say so.
And sometimes, Brandy, I'll say that you and other, you know, for instance, Dory, I think that sometimes people listen so they can be like, I know that's wrong. How do I, and not necessarily for Whoopi, but
right.
I know that's wrong. How do I make that case to other people who come at me with these comments and whatever? So I think that that's a good, it's also good to put that into words, right. Why these people have to be called out. So
right. You have a huge platform in The View. And to, again, I go back to, we really talk about actions before affiliation. Right. And to me, that's the solution to our division in America. is everybody decides for themselves that they're going to prioritize somebody's words and actions without considering their political affiliation. Mm-hmm. And then that way you judge everyone based on what they're actually saying, what they're actually doing, who they are, without looking at their political party and deciding, do I let them off the hook for that? Mm-hmm. Do I let them off the hook for saying something that if it were done or said by another person of an ideology I disagree with, that I would have a problem with it?
Right.
And that's why I've been so angry about inconsistency about the summer of love in Seattle and then January 6th. To me, those were both instances of political violence. It makes me so mad when people try to downplay what happened at the U.S. Capitol. Because if it were BLM that did the exact same thing, that marched in the exact same thing, do you think that those same people would downplay it? Of course not. And the same with the politicians in Seattle, who turned a blind eye to violence and vandalism for months.
Right.
I mean, people tried to kill officers by setting the East Precinct on fire. And they said, the city council said nothing. And then you fast forward 6 months, January 6th happened, and they're like, oh, political violence. I'm like, where were you all summer?
Right.
And that's what really bothers me. But then that's why I go back to January 6th. And people always are like, oh, well, they're political prisoners and whatever. And I try to ask them, how would you feel about that if it were Antifa who had marched in on the Capitol in that way, who had done the exact same thing? It goes back to actions before affiliation. We can't be okay with any form of political violence. And when you try to downplay something like January 6th, then I think you lose standing to go after the political violence on the left.
Now, I'm sure that there are people that downplayed it. I'm talking about the way that it's handled. I think that reaction gets lumped in with acceptance. And I think that the difference was, you know, who got charged in the summer of love? No, not a lot of people.
Maybe a few people, like the ones who stole the guns and lit cars on fire.
Right?
Yeah.
And in this case, it was. I think that's what people get most upset about. And so then they get upset about people being taken care of or, you know, charged in the January 6th case. And then they're called supporters of it, which I don't think that's what people are necessarily supporting. It's just that they're saying, let's handle all of these things the same, right?
And I totally agree with that sentiment. As long as it doesn't come across as sympathy,
right?
That's the issue. Like, I don't have sympathy for anyone who assaults a police officer. I don't care if you did it in downtown Seattle or if you did it on the steps of the U.S. Capitol. I have no sympathy for you. Right. I think you belong in federal prison. I do not blame people for getting angry that the media treated January 6th as so significantly different than what played out for a full year in this country.
Right.
Because again, political violence is political violence. I think it took on a different meaning when it happened at the nation's capital under those circumstances. Right. But still, you can't downplay one and then try to, you know, find excuses for the other.
And going back to the Whoopi Goldberg, I would say that her saying Antifa is an idea is kind of similar to this mega Republican thing, right? Saying that there's these mega Republicans that are all, and I mean, sure, there's a few like Antifa, there's a few that are probably lump themselves in the mega Republicans, but that's not the majority and that's not the Republicans party, right? And they're getting, it's an idea. It was
100%.
A phrase that was used and now everybody is mega Republican or whatever it is. And I think that, yes, when it's convenient for them, they can assign an idea versus a group, and it's just inconsistent. And that's why we have to highlight it and say she's wrong.
Right, she's wrong. Yeah, and I will say I also am annoyed when peaceful protesters are lumped in with non-peaceful protesters. I try very hard not to do that in Seattle because there are times like May Day where you've had 10,000 peaceful marchers, then you've got
like this. I mean, we didn't
eight
hear anything
Antifa
about May Day this
right
year.
And the same with January 6th. People who attended the president's speech but didn't go down to the Capitol should not be vilified in the same way that people who went down to the Capitol are. They attended a speech from a president. Bizarre to me. I want to really quickly, I know we'll read comments here in a moment, but there was one from Two Ladies Midwest Adventures on YouTube. Brandy, quick question. You don't have, oh no, that's not it. Sorry. That's a funny one. Where did this go? Oh, Leah on YouTube. In regards to January 6th, and maybe you've touched on this, why did the cops let them in? And people will often use that as an excuse. Oh, the police let them in. They thought they were welcome to be there. First of all, that's like saying when Chaz Chop happened in Seattle. The police abandoned that precinct. Does it make what followed okay? No. They abandoned the precinct because they felt like they couldn't hold the position anymore and they didn't want these continued clashes night after night. If you look at pictures taken by Getty Images, the Associated Press, on the steps of the U.S. Capitol, you will see images of police officers being assaulted and trying to hold a crowd back. Now, why they decided eventually in some areas of the Capitol to let them in, I don't know. But that doesn't make it okay. The same as it doesn't make it okay in Seattle when police abandoned the East Precinct and then you had rioters take over six square blocks of the area and patrol it like it was an autonomous zone. So I've never understood or gotten that argument. Anyway, wow. That whole thing did get me fired up. Let's change gears. EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. EastsideWeightLossClinic.com, one of our wonderful sponsors here on the podcast. I've heard from so many of you who have started the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic plan with Dr. Ryan Coogan and are doing awesome. I saw a woman the other day who said that she's down 20 pounds, probably more by now, and that her husband also was doing the program with her and was doing very well. And I have personally lost 35 pounds on the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic plan. And I'm feeling great. And I'm still just trucking along.
Gotta update that graphic.
Well, I know it says 34 pounds. I'll update it. So if you want to try the program, no prepackaged meals, you don't have to go into an office to be weighed. You have accountability to someone. Dr. Ryan Coogan is great. And what I'll also say about it is I lost most of my weight in 2 months. It was just weight I was carrying around from the pandemic. And so it came off just really quickly because my body did not want to be holding on to it. So if you have something coming up this summer where you would like to get back in shape, there's 2 months till summer, so it's a great time to start. So EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. That's EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. Schedule a free 15-minute consultation to see if the program is right for you and mention you heard about them on the Undivided Podcast. Okay, let's see here. Let's get to some comments, shall we? On the special session, David on Facebook writes, conservatives need to quit opposing progress. Let's just get it done. Quit stalling. I guess I don't understand that comment. Democrats are in control of the House, the Senate, and the governor's office. If Democrats wanted to get a bill done, they would have done it during the legislative session, and they don't need any approval from Republicans. But thank God there are a few moderate Democrats who agreed with Republicans that there needed to be a strong enough bill around drug possession to make sure that people don't continue to die on our streets. And so the whole idea that conservatives or Republicans would really have any say whatsoever in what the legislature does is a little bit ridiculous. They only get a say when Democrats let them have a say. And I think it's a good thing that Republicans and Democrats, some of them behind the scenes, are working together on this. Because drug possession is not a blue or drug abuse is not a blue or red issue. We see it in communities across the state from Seattle to Spokane. And we should all be united in wanting to make sure that people don't die in squalor on our streets with a needle in their arm. It's unacceptable, and it is proven that a good response to substance abuse is a carrot and a stick. To, at every opportunity, give people a chance to turn their lives around, that's what we all want, right? We want people to go from shooting up drugs on the street to being a productive member of society, but sometimes it does take the threat or the possibility of arrest or jail time to be able to get someone to turn their lives around in extreme instances. So I guess I don't get the comment about conservatives need to quit opposing progress. What kind of progress are you talking about? The drug crisis on our streets, is that progress? The homelessness crisis on our streets, is that progress? The crime crisis on our streets, is that progress? If that's progress, I don't want any part of it. Matthew writes on YouTube, I like Farrell too, but once again, voting D always comes first at the end of the day. I'm talking about Federal Way Mayor Jim Farrell endorsing Bob Ferguson for the governorship. I don't know for him it had more to do with the personal relationship, you know, going back years, or with the fact that he's a Democrat, or with the fact that Bob Ferguson is probably going to be the next governor. Sergeant Pickles said, I think the real battle will be convincing Republicans to get behind a moderate Democrat who actually has a shot. And I agree. I don't know if Republicans can come up with anyone who can win. And so then you might be left at the end of the day having to decide what's more important to me, checking the box for someone with an R next to their name, or checking the box for someone who isn't a Republican but isn't as bad as Bob Ferguson. And I think that's some soul searching everyone's going to have to do. But at the same time, we're 18 months away. I'm exhausted already. No, there's no reason a gubernatorial campaign needs to be 18 months long. It's ridiculous. I think there should be like an 8-month limit where it's like you can't campaign outside that 8 months. Just so everybody can... Same with the House of Representatives. I understand why the terms are varied, why you've got 6 years in the Senate, 2 years in the House, 4 years for the presidency, and then you don't have this like whole changeover of government every 2 or 4 years. But you look at members of Congress, they never stop campaigning. 2 years? That's virtually nothing. They run in 2022 and they've got to be running again in 2024. It is nonstop campaigning. How can you serve the people of your district when you are that focused, and you have to be, on constantly trying to keep your job, especially in swing districts? I mean, if you're in a safe district where you're not going to be primaried, then that's a little different. You don't have to spend as much time obsessed with campaigning. But for people like Kim Schreier in the 8th Congressional District, that's a constant job, campaigning, flying to D.C., back home, campaigning. I would never want that responsibility because that sounds absolutely exhausting to me. All right. Jennifer says, I already got a text from Bob asking for money. You did? Send it to us, Jennifer. Undividedpod.com. Just go to undividedpod.com and there's a little email thing. You can email us. I want to see it. Let's see. Andy says on Patreon, that list is a who is who of progressives. Farrell is the only moderate. And look at the blowback. Oh, you're talking about the list of people endorsing Bob Ferguson. Yeah. A lot of progressives, mostly progressives. And that's why I think Jim Farrell stuck out to me, where I'm like, Jim, don't do that. Don't let me down, Jim. But if it's a personal relationship thing, it's hard for me to fault him on that. But I go back and forth on it. Let's see here. Matt Gilbert says, MAGA means make America great again. Are you against making America great? I'm assuming you're referring to the Democrats who put that in every tweet. Like, MAGA Republicans want to do this. MAGA Republicans want to do that. I mean, they've assigned a negative connotation to MAGA. And so they're associating, when they say MAGA, they're saying Donald Trump Republicans. That's essentially what they're doing. And so I understand the tactic. I think it's deeply disingenuous because they call absolutely everything, every Republican, a MAGA Republican. It's their tried and true tactic. And maybe it's working for them. So maybe that's why they do it. Okay, comments on The View. Oh, sorry, we're going a little over today. A little over an hour. The View, Leah says, highlight the lies. I appreciate the truth and calling them out. So on whether we should continue to play clips from The View. Christopher says, we all appreciate you watching so we don't have to suffer through it. You're welcome. You're welcome. There's a lot of government meetings I've watched where I'm like, wow. Just like Bob Ferguson, I'm an American hero for watching these meetings so you guys don't have to. Okay. And that should be enough to subscribe right there. $5 a month so we watch the meetings so you don't have to. So we watch The View so you don't have to. Crafty Grandma Crispy. Has she changed? She added Crispy to the end?
I guess.
You haven't told us what you craft yet, Crafty Grandma Crispy. It's good to know that you are fighting against what you are fighting against. That's true. Jackie says on Patreon, no, keep playing the clips, not acknowledging false prophets. It just spreads their message without a challenge to it. It's like accepting it. And I think that's a good point, is like a lot of people are watching it already. So do we just let it just go out into the ether unchallenged, or do we point out the factual inaccuracies of it and the hypocrisy of it? Let's fit one more in. Michelle on Patreon, for me, it just reiterates what a joke The View is. I really don't think your viewers are watching The View. They are the antithesis of your mission, 100%. The View is, sometimes The View will have a guest host that's like trying to talk reason into them. And I just feel so bad for that person. I'm like, oh man, you want exposure that bad that you agreed to go on The View? Would I, if The View invited me, would you approve of me going on?
Yes.
Because what I would do is I'd flame it.
Make them look.
And I would never,
as
I would,
dumb as they sound
there. I would go on with the expectation I would never be invited back. Yeah. And that's a very powerful position to be in. Mm-hmm. Where you're like, I don't care if I never get invited back. So I'm just going to roast all these women.
I'm going to start working on that.
Follow their producers and stuff on like all the social media and like their stuff. So like, yeah. Oh, who's this woman? Oh, we have a master plan now. I am so, so excited. Okay, let us end. Oh, it's a good one today. Our daily dose of sanity. Man, I thought I saw it all. The White House announcing that they are going to drop their COVID-19 vaccine mandate, which lets you know that COVID is way, way, way behind us. The White House putting out a press release saying the Biden-Harris administration will end COVID-19 vaccination requirements for federal employees, contractors, international travelers, blah, 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 blah. And that mandate has been in place since 2021. And look, this is a good thing. It is way too late. I mean, it never should have happened in the first place. But even if I give people the benefit of the doubt and say, hey, when we were in the pandemic, we weren't really sure that the vaccine, whether the vaccine was going to be our path out. Like, I'll give people a little grace for that. But as soon as we realized that breakthrough cases weren't breakthrough, they were the normal, and that you could still get and give COVID even with the vaccine, then it's ridiculous to mandate it as a condition of someone making a living. That's just silly. I will say, I still believe that the vaccine did show in the numbers that there was less likelihood of serious illness or death. But I also think the complications of the vaccine went woefully undercovered and ignored by the mainstream media. So all that to say, great for the White House. Nicole, can you join me in a golf? No, not too loud. A little golf clap. Good. Now, one of the reasons why this is in our sanity check for today is I think it's a very sane thing to drop the vaccine mandate, although it's too late. But I couldn't help but be reminded of old Bob Ferguson in his exploratory campaign video yesterday talking about healthcare freedom.
Here's what I believe. Washingtonians must have the freedom to make their own healthcare decisions.
Oh, well, that's nice. So I went over to the AG's website today and thought, well, that must mean that Bob Ferguson has lifted the vaccine mandate for his own employees, because he just said in his exploratory campaign video that he believes that Washingtonians should have the freedom to make their own healthcare decisions. So let's take a look at the Attorney General's website, shall we? Oh, okay. So the Attorney General is still mandating that his employees not only have the vaccine, but are up to date on their boosters. And I should also say that this is the same office that, to the best of my knowledge, still requires reporters to prove that they are fully vaccinated to go into press conferences at the Attorney General's office. So here we have a situation where even Joe Biden is saying, oh, we don't need the vaccine mandate anymore. Bob Ferguson, in his own exploratory campaign video, says, I believe in healthcare freedom, but he is still mandating as a condition of employment that his employees get the COVID-19 vaccine. And that is truly insane. All right, that's it for today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Make sure you like. Somebody told me how YouTube works. You gotta like the video. And you know, that's why when I was on Timcast, he's always like, smash that like button. Mm-hmm. And now I know why, is it really helps with analytics. So we want more people to see the videos. So you gotta like the video if you watch it. But most importantly, help us grow our mission and our movement by becoming an Undivided subscriber. In fact, tomorrow evening, we're gonna have our April subscriber Q&A, which was supposed to happen on Sunday, but I had to reschedule it. So just ignore the fact that it's going to happen on May 4th. But I do a live Q&A exclusive for subscribers every month. And so we're going to do our April Q&A coming up tomorrow evening. So be on the lookout for that. So now's a great time to sign up. As little as $5 a month. Go to undividedpod.com. That's undividedpod.com. It's a one-stop shop for all things Undivided. You can figure out how to watch the show, listen to the show if you prefer to do that. You can send Nicole and I an email with a hot news tip or whatever you feel like sending us. Maybe a...
not whatever.
Well, yeah, no pics, if you know what I mean, okay? But if you want to go on a date with Nicole, that's a great place to send an email. Perfect. Nicole's mortified. Or you can find out how to subscribe to support the show for as little as $5 a month. We cannot do it without you. I will see you all back on the live show tomorrow at noon. And then for subscribers, I will see you tomorrow evening for our monthly live Q&A.